Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The Republican National Convention is later this month. The Democratic Convention will follow in August. In normal years, that's what most voters would be focusing on, but this is not a normal year. This year is marked by two candidates that only highly partisan individuals are excited about. Despite his many accomplishments, there are concerns about President Biden's age and ability to endure another 4 years, exacerbated by his debate performance and not particularly helped by his 22-minute interview with George Stephanopoulos on Friday on ABC. His rival, Donald Trump, is the first presidential candidate and former president to be convicted of 34 felony counts. He faces 57 more felony counts in a state court and two different federal courts. He lost a civil suit in New York that could hobble his business empire and a pair of defamation judgments. Despite the jury in the E. Jean Carroll defamation case not finding him guilty of raping her, the judge said, quote, "Indeed, as the evidence at trial makes clear, Mr. Trump, in fact, did rape her." He stands accused of attempting to change the outcome of the 2020 election and of trying to find votes he didn't earn in Georgia. He faces charges in connection with his removal of documents from the White House, some top secret, when he left office, and of willful retention of national security information, obstruction of justice, and making false statements to the federal government. And he's been charged with four federal felonies in connection with his attempt to remain in power after losing the last election. There are more, but we don't have time. Any of these would have doomed the chances of any other candidate, and yet Trump is leading Biden in the polls, and none of this seems to matter, even to the courts that have paused forward motion on many of these cases. And speaking of the courts, the United States Supreme Court has made a habit recently of ignoring precedent and overturning established law by ruling against those laws and reversing previous high court decisions, while several conservative members are suspected of violating normal ethical practices. All of this while the Federalist Society has published the Project 2025 plan that, if enacted, would fundamentally change the character of the nation and how it operates. Clearly, a lot is at stake in the November election, and that is why we are reviving our Politics Mondays series of programs designed to help us get our bearings in this sea of turmoil so that you can make an informed decision when you go to the polls. And we begin today. Steve Harrison, WFAE's political reporter, is here, along with Mary C. Curtis, a columnist for RollCall.com and host of their Equal Time podcast. And Dr. Michael Bitzer joins us. He's a professor of politics and history at Catawba College. Good morning, everyone. Welcome back.
Good morning. Can I take a nap after that?
Sure. It's a long way of starting a series, but the series will go a long time. So I figure we'll get it out of the way now. Steve, is anything that I just listed a fair assessment? Did I leave anything out? Did I get anything wrong?
I think you pretty much covered it, Mike. And the thing that struck me when you did your rundown is that the 34 felony convictions against the former president seems like a million years ago. It was 2 weeks ago, but it is, you know, after the Biden debate and all of the recent news, it just seems like an eternity to go. And it may feel that way for voters. It will probably come back, but at this moment, it seems like ancient history.
The media is being criticized in some circles for concentrating on Joe Biden's performance in the debate and even his conversation with George Stephanopoulos on Friday. And we're going to talk about all of that, Michael, but let's talk about the other side of this coin, the Trump side of the coin. How do you explain someone who is facing so many charges and has been convicted of so many others, a person who had to close down Trump University because it was fraudulent? He had to close down his Trump charitable foundation also for fraud. He's been able to garner so much support from the very kinds of people who he hurt in many of these ventures. How do you explain it?
In a word, partisanship. I mean, what we are is a calcified partisan country. And if you look at any of the numbers.
But Michael, there are plenty of partisan people on the conservative side of the aisle who don't have any of this baggage with them, who would be good candidates. How do you explain Trump being the victor? Always.
Because the Republican Party is now the Trump Republican Party. As we have seen since 2015, his hold on the party as the base voters, as an organization, even among the elites, are now all beholden to Donald Trump. And this is a phenomenon that we have not seen in recent American political history in terms of how much dominance one person and his personality has over an entire major political party, and layer on top of that the partisan strength and loyalty that these folks have towards a political party nowadays. It's the dynamic of what we're seeing, and as many people are scratching their heads, but it's very simple. It's personality and it's partisanship.
And Mary, as Donald Trump himself said back, I think it was in 2016, he could stand on the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody and nobody would care. And that's proven to be true, while the Democrats, meanwhile, have tied themselves in knots over fears that the president may not be up to another 4 years based on his debate performance, a mediocre interview with George Stephanopoulos in which several of the answers were unsatisfactory, and some visible signs of decline, if not mental, certainly physical. And yet the GOP is solidly behind a convicted felon, a criminal. What does that say about the country, our two political parties, the voters themselves? What does it say?
Well, to follow up on what Michael said, it is partisanship. It's people getting their information from different silos. It's different standards. And I think the media, and we'll get into that, is somewhat at fault. I saw something where someone said Biden stumbled. He said trillion instead of billion, or vice versa, had to correct himself. And I almost had to say, really? Yeah, Donald Trump gives these speeches about, is it better to be, die from a shark or electrocuted? He goes off on tangents. He makes up words. At the debate, he spews falsehoods. I think that's why some people were so upset with President Biden, because there were so many openings in which he could have just basically turned and said, what you're saying is not true, and then give the truth. There are different sets of standards. It's almost as though it's baked in that Trump will lie, that Trump will curse and be crude, that Trump will insult people. But for Democrats, they're still trying to act as if it's a normal political atmosphere. And I think sometimes, as I said, that the media reports in that way. I mean, the Republicans are just standing back now, watching the Democrats eat their own. But Trump is still, if you look on, I mean, he's not been in the public eye, but if you look on Truth Social, he's been saying very wild things. And, you can tell that he knows that some of the extreme views expressed in the Project 2025 report, they're hurting him. And he says, well, I never heard of it. And then you look on media that is right-wing media, and people will say, well, Trump said he never heard of it, even though many of his people are involved in creating it. And, you know, Trump did great. We all know that if Trump had passed out on that debate stage, people would applaud and say, this is a piece of drama that he brought to the stage. Yeah. And I find that very disturbing, that our standards are so different. And, some of the things that he's saying and planning on doing, this is somebody who brags about putting on three Supreme Court justices who overturned Roe v. Wade after promising in confirmation hearings that they would respect precedent. And we're still seeing the fallout from it. And yet this race is close.
Steve, both sides have criticized the media, which means we must be doing something right. Biden criticized the media during his interview with George Stephanopoulos. He's only heard negatives from the media about his candidacy. And journalists, of course, struggled from the lead up to the 2016 election throughout the Trump presidency, and once again, with how to deal with such an unconventional candidate and president, meaning Donald Trump. We slowly began to describe the inaccuracies he regularly engaged in as lies, to the point where now we openly characterize most of what he says as either a lie or something based on hyperbole for which there is no evidence. We began to call this not normal. Now the denial of facts, the posing of alternative facts, the outright lying is an infection that has spread to an entire political party. How do we cover that? How do you report on that in a manner that is fair but unflinching?
I don't think there's been any shortage in the media of negative coverage or critical coverage of Trump. I don't think that's there's been a problem with that. I think in the last 2 weeks, we've had a deluge of coverage on Biden because this is an entirely different story. It goes beyond the November election. You know, a key part of this story is the president. It's not so much is he fit to win election, is he fit to be president right now in 2024? That's a huge story. I think that, you know, that the media, if anything, on the issue of Biden's competence, his ability to be president, I think that a lot of media in Washington downplayed that story for a long time. The debate kind of broke it out into the open. I think the media is playing some catch up, but it's an enormous story. And I think the media now is covering it correctly. And but there will be something else that comes along. We'll have the RNC next week. Like I said before, this news cycle is so fast. But I think in the present time, it's an enormous story and it's getting the attention it should.
But some people will say that this is an existential election and that the media has a responsibility to continually pound away at that and make people who are only partially interested in politics and really only in the week before the actual vote takes place, to make them understand what's at stake here. Do we, in fact, have that responsibility?
Well, Steve. if the argument that it is an existential election, democracy's at stake, et cetera, then the Democrats need to run the best possible candidate to defeat Donald Trump. And there are a lot of questions in the party among, you know, ordinary voters, among Democratic leaders, whether President Biden is that person. So I think if the idea that this is an existential election, then it's pretty fair to question whether President Biden is their best guy.
Trumpism has reformed the Republic or reshaped the Republican Party. The GOP has been associated with very conservative principles, with fiscal responsibility, with a clear-eyed vision of the importance of American strength in the world, in maintaining stability and safety in a free world, and encouraging developing democracies to be more like us. Michael, how would you describe the GOP today?
So what we typically talk about is the three-legged conservative stool of fiscal conservatism, national defense conservatism, and social conservatism. I'd say right now one of those legs is much more predominant and much more enlarged, and that is social conservatism. You mentioned the Project 2025 report. That's actually out of the Heritage Foundation, not the Federalist Society. But there are a lot of people that are putting input into that. And if you read through some of the social issues, there are very clear, hardcore social conservatism planks within that report. Now, that report has been generated by the Heritage Foundation since Reagan's time. So we have, you know, a track record of what they are proposing the new administration do if they win. But certainly, I think the party itself has moved more and more towards the lines of social conservatism.
And that has filtered down beyond the presidential race into contests and governments across the country at the local and state level. We'll talk a little bit about that when we come back and more about the race for the White House that we are witnessing unfold right now. It's Politics Monday on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaOfSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Steve Harrison, WFAE's political reporter. Michael Bitzer is a professor of politics and history at Catawba College, and Mary C. Curtis is with us, columnist and host, columnist with RollCall.com, host of their Equal Time podcast. Mary, these changes that the Republican Party has gone through nationally have filtered down, and maybe it could be argued that they actually bubbled up, trickled up from the bottom up at the school board level and beyond, up into national politics. Nonetheless, we're like a test tube full of this in North Carolina. North Carolina's Republican gubernatorial candidate, Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson, is a prime example, along with the legislature, which has worked very hard to gerrymander and re-gerrymander voting districts in their favor to diminish the influence of certain groups of voters, to corral more power for their branch of government at the expense of the other branches. Can democracy withstand this?
I'm not sure. We're very confident in America that we can withstand anything. But we've seen times in our history where it's come very close. We've seen times, as in Reconstruction, where it seemed to be close to democracy, then the opposing forces came, and we had decades and decades of repression, Jim Crow, intimidation, and violence. So I think Americans tend to remember the good parts and you know, just go through the parts in which there was a real struggle. As you said, now the Republican Party is the party of Trump. You have to be with Trump or like Trump, which we see in North Carolina. On the national level, folks like Marco Rubio, J.D. Vance, Lindsey Graham, who were staunch on anti-Trumpists. You know, Lindsey Graham on national security, totally opposed. And now they are either vying to be his vice president or to just say the, you know, be really just subservient to everything he believes in. In North Carolina, which we think of as kind of a purple state, the Republican primary for governor had some run-of-the-mill kind of Republicans. And then you had Mark Robinson, the lieutenant governor, who did not have much governing experience at all. But he is Trump-like in the way he is bombastic in his, the things he says. I think just recently he was in a church and he will say it was or wasn't in context, but when you're in front of a cross and you say some folks need killing, it doesn't seem like a Christ-like message. And that's who the voters chose. So North Carolina, they have clear choices. And in the legislature, we see, you know, in the state that was, you know, well, the congressional district, 7 Republicans, 7 Democrats, now because of gerrymandering, it's gonna be totally out of whack where it comes to that. And we see in the state legislature vetoing and then overturning the veto of Governor Cooper, a Democratic governor, on all sorts of things. And all of the things that are going through the states, like vouchers for private schools, things like that, they also find a home right here in North Carolina. So we are really at a test, and we see all the Democrats are trying to win North Carolina. It's the state that Trump won by the slimmest margin in 2020. But the Democrats realize that if they're in trouble, that North Carolina's 15 electoral votes can be a backstop in case things go south in states like Georgia and Arizona. So we see Jill Biden's here and Kamala Harris and Joe Biden. They come here again and again. And it will be very interesting to see which way North Carolina goes. It's going to be turnout.
I'm right about this, Steve, but the Democrats seem to wring their hands more often than the Republicans do about in reaction to things that they fear might weaken them in some way. And of course, this debate performance that the president had was by any measure pretty awful. And this morning, I think we're somewhere around 11 or 12 congressional Democrats, House Democrats, who are calling for the president to drop out of the race. These are not people in leadership, but it's being said in some circles that it's giving people in leadership, like Hakeem Jeffries and Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi, license to go down Pennsylvania Avenue to the White House and have a meeting with Joe in which they say, you got to drop out. Is that what's going on here?
Yeah, I think we've had about half a dozen sitting Democrats from swing districts who have publicly said that the president should drop out. And then I believe that the Post and the New York Times have reported that some members in leadership in the House have kind of privately said that. that we haven't gotten to the point where they have publicly called on him to. Here in North Carolina, I don't believe any prominent Democrats have. Alma Adams, I think, told WREL she has no comment. Jeff Jackson is not commenting on the situation. Governor Cooper was on that call last week, the Zoom call with the president, and came out in support of him staying in the race. Yeah, Mike, to your point, we're at about half a dozen right now, and we'll see if any more come loose.
And I know, Michael, you don't think highly of Alan Lichtman. He's a professor of history at American University who has what he calls the 13 keys to the White House test, that he has successfully predicted the outcome of every presidential election except one since Ronald Reagan came to office. And he said it would be disastrous for the Democrats to pull the plug on Joe Biden at this point because he holds six of the 13 keys. If he stays in, he is likely to win, despite what the polls say. If he gets out, they lose at least one key if they put Kamala Harris in. That's incumbency. They keep the incumbency key, evidently. But if it's not her, then they lose two and Trump wins. Any comment on that at all?
Well, if you load up the formula with enough factors, you can predict just about anything with accuracy.
Well, there are 13 factors.
I mean, that's why I say 13 factors. You give me 13 opportunities, I bet you I'll probably come real close in terms of predicting things. But, you know, what this tells us is that we are indeed an evenly divided country. You talked about some of the Democrats that have called into question whether Joe Biden should be their nominee. We also had reports that Mark Warner, a U.S. senator from Virginia, was going to kind of get his colleagues together and talk about this issue. We now have news this morning breaking of the president sending a letter to all congressional Democrats. And he ends by saying, any weakening of resolve or lack of clarity about the task only helps Trump and hurts us. It is time to come together, move forward as a unified party, and defeat Donald Trump. That's what he's been saying for the past week. That's what he's been saying for the past week. Well, we'll find out come November 5th. I think we're all kind of obsessed with is the election tomorrow. Folks, news alert, election is November 5th, okay? So, you know, if we're talking about the polling, which is, again, snapshots in time, let's kind of take a breath about all of this. Is the president weakened? Yes. That debate performance cannot be looked at anything other than dismal in that regard. Is there time for him to recoup? Yes, but the questions oftentimes become about trust and confidence, in our national leaders. And if that is shaken, what can the president do to instill that and make that a campaign argument?
You know, all of this rigmarole on the Democratic side of the aisle is happening because of that debate performance. And many Democrats probably knew it was going to look very much like that and were hoping and praying that some miracle would happen and it wouldn't look like that because, in all honesty, he has been. He's not the Joe Biden that won this election 3.5 years ago. Mary, we place a lot of importance on these debates. Debates require performance. Sitting in the Oval Office making decisions does not. Debates require you to be a TV personality, of which it cannot. There's no arguing that Donald Trump is one of those. He's a reality show host. Should we rid ourselves of these debates? Do we learn anything? Are they in any way valuable? Because, first of all, it's completely artificial. They are not debates. They are question and answer sessions with time limits put on the questions. Presidents cannot explain, and no one can explain, the complex issues that presidents deal with in 2 minutes with 30 seconds for a rebuttal. It's ridiculous. Shouldn't they just hold town halls where the president answers questions from voters and has no time limit put on him for that, or have sit-downs like with George Stephanopoulos that go longer than 22 minutes?
Well, I think we just have to say debates are a part of our modern political
system. But should they
system.
Be? We've seen well, that they're just nonsense.
But the thing of it is, you know, how much do they matter? Folks would say that Hillary Clinton won all of her debates with Donald Trump in 2016, and it didn't seem to matter. I think why this mattered was that the criticism of Biden was that, is he too old? And people saw at the State of the Union just a few months ago, he was very vigorous. I think it was when the performance reads into a narrative that's already building. That's why it's very different from the fact that Barack Obama had a bad first debate against Mitt Romney. I do think what it says is overblown. And I think the frustration among Democrats was that Donald Trump had a bad performance as well. He didn't answer the questions. He spouted falsehoods. And CNN had said they were not going to fact check. So it was up to the Democrat to make that case as soon as he did that. Joe Biden had opportunities and he didn't. That said, I think to recover, he is going to have to do what you said, more speeches. He hasn't had as many press conferences as Biden and had at this, I'm sorry, as Barack Obama had at the same time. He is going to have to go out there and go out in spaces that may not be particularly hospitable to him. We saw over the weekend, he went to a church in Philadelphia with a predominantly Black congregation where he did get a very rousing, supportive response and applause. Well, he has to go out into the world and see many more people about that. I mean, it was better than, I mean, when Donald Trump went to a church in Detroit that was supposedly a Black church, there were quite a few white people in the congregation. and he doesn't exactly go, you know, just for that. But that's what he is going to have to do. And it's not fair. It may not be fair. Donald Trump is old and he says many things, but his intensity and his animus reads as vigor. Because even if he says something false, he says it with conviction.
The very next day after the debate, the president went out, I think it was in North Carolina, and made a speech that was full of vigor and very much like the State of the Union. And as an observer and as someone who knows a little bit about voice production, I will tell you that at his age, the reason he looks ancient at the debate, partly not answers notwithstanding, his vocal production in a room where there is no audience, and the same is true for the George Stephanopoulos interview, he can talk at a normal level and he can't produce the voice he used to produce at that level. But when he yells to a crowded room, he can. And I think people ought to make a note of that going forward. Just see if I'm not right about this.
He also rides bikes and Donald Trump rides golf carts, but we won't get into that.
So the last few months have been bad for the Biden campaign. That debate put an exclamation point on it, Michael. But he's been neck and neck in the polls with Donald Trump for months now, with one going ahead or behind by a point or two. And yet Democrats point to what they call an extraordinary set of accomplishments. They've compared him to FDR and to LBJ. And I think the LBJ comparison is apt in terms of the amount of material he's been able to push through Congress. Voters don't seem to notice or don't seem to care. I mean, is the problem the messaging? Is it the what is the problem there? Why isn't that getting through?
It could be a combination of things. It could be the fact that, you know, you've done all that for me yesterday. What are you going to do for me tomorrow? I think, you know, what the American voter really wants to know is, where is this country going to go? We are in deep divided territory. A lot of people are unhappy with these two major candidates at the top of the ticket. And I think what the president needs to do is to indeed lay out the vision of where he wants to go. He has been hitting on where Donald Trump will take us. He needs to present the notion of where he wants this country to go. Yes, he's been talking about, and that's what most first-term presidents do, about all the accomplishments. But oftentimes what voters want is a prospective view. Tell me what you're going to do other than prevent Donald Trump and his administration from coming into power.
Donald Trump, Steve, has long displayed authoritarian tendencies and openly expressed admiration for dictators and strongmen and their approach to government. The Republican Party has solidly backed Trump, and therefore we can assume they have embraced that approach as well. And Project 2025, if put into place, would move this country in an authoritarian direction. How do you explain voters, Trump voters, and the appeal of anti-democratic principles to them?
Well, I think they feel that there is a huge fight in this country, whereas Democrats look at Republicans and see those things you described, authoritarian tendencies, et cetera. Many Republicans look at the left and feel like that they are under attack from Democrats. And so they feel under threat. They feel under siege. I think the question will be, as we move into October, whether that message that the Biden campaign has been pushing about the threat to democracy, et cetera, whether that will finally, I think, sink in with a small group of voters in the middle. I don't think it has yet, but I think there's still plenty of time for that message to resonate among a very small group of people to give President Biden the victory. But right now it hasn't, but I think there's still many, many weeks for that to sink in.
And they're going to have to break it down into practical terms, Mike. I mean, you know, the Supreme Court just said that the federal government, that they really have agency over federal agencies like the Environmental Protection Agency and things like that. So Neil Gorsuch wrote in the opinion, he confused nitrogen oxide, a pollutant, with nitrous oxide, a laughing gas. So, you know, they're going to have to say to voters, do you really want these judges that they are putting in, the Republicans are putting in, deciding how much pollutants are going to go in your streams and your water supply and your air when they don't even know the difference between a pollutant and laughing gas? They're going to have to bring it down. Insulin prices, senior health care, these kinds of things. I think part of it is messaging. How is it, as Michael said, going to affect me if this happens?
He said, Donald Trump has said, Mary, he wants to be a dictator on day one. And if you look through history, there's not a single dictator on day one who didn't remain so for their entire time in power. The Republican Party leaders are meeting in Milwaukee this week to sit down and cobble out their Republican platform. Last time it was whatever Trump wants is our platform. This time they're trying to work in some of this Project 2025 stuff from the Heritage Foundation, and that all of, and the senior leaders that Trump will likely have in the White House should he return are all in on Project 2025. But they don't want to publicize this in their convention. They're not putting it on television. I have 30 seconds. Is there skullduggery going on in Milwaukee this week?
Well, we won't know because we won't be able to be allowed in there, but they're going to be as vague as possible, particularly on issues like abortion and things like abolishing the Department of Education and the Civil Service, because they don't want really voters to know exactly what they're planning to do.
When we come back, among the things we'll talk about, the polls. Do we put too much emphasis on polls? Are polls accurate anymore? The Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks and Politics Monday on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins here with Steve Harrison, WFAE's political reporter, Mary C. Curtis, columnist at RollCall.com, and Dr. Michael Bitzer, professor of politics and history at Catawba College. Steve, we place a lot of emphasis on polls. They are a snapshot in time. And the only poll that really matters is what happens on Election Day when people go in to the election booth. They're not going to lie to the machine. They're going to vote their conscience, and they may struggle with that in the booth and make a final decision in the booth. 538, the website, reports the average of the polls that they use has Trump up 6.4 points over Biden. They show Biden having a 57.2 disapproval rating. Trump has a 53.5 unfavorable rating. So do we make too much of these polls? Do they help? Do they hurt our politics by predisposing voters before they make their decisions? In other words, if the polls have the other candidate up so much, why bother? Or why would you waste your vote on a loser?
I don't think, Mike, that's been the case for many, many elections. I mean, so many elections recently have been close that that I don't think we've been in a situation where, you know, one person, one candidate is up 10 or 15 or 20 and the other side says it's not even worth it. I mean, we have been in close elections now, you know, for 20 years or 25 years. You know, I think with the polls, it's interesting to look. Democrats were doing a lot of complaining about the polls and whether they meant anything. And then after the conviction, after Trump was convicted in New York, Biden gained in the polls and pulled ahead slightly in the polling averages. I didn't hear many complaints then. Now he's falling down again, and you're starting to hear some of the same talk. I mean, remember back in 2012 when Republicans went with Romney, Obama, and they were just kind of changing the polls to put their guy ahead. I think both sides, when the polls are not favorable, are very critical of them. But I think they're very useful. I think by and large, they're reasonably accurate. And, you know, but I'm not sure how much ordinary people pay attention to them.
Michael, accurate or not, George Stephanopoulos on Friday night pointed out that during his interview with the president that he'd never seen a president with a 37.1 approval rating win re-election. And that is where the president was on Friday. And that's based on polling data, and people do lie to pollsters, and people don't respond as quickly and as often to pollsters because people don't answer their phones anymore.
I think that's the more prevalent one.
Yeah.
People don't respond.
How worried? So the sample size is skewed or reduced. So how worried should Democrats, how worried should Joe Biden be that a president with his approval rating has never been elected?
I think it is worrisome. I mean, I think when you're talking about in the mid 30s, that is not where you want to be. Now, the counterpart to that is we are still in July. We haven't really had the full attention of the American electorate tune in. That's usually around Labor Day when the general campaign will start. We've got two conventions to get through along with the Olympics. So, you know, it's building towards the fall. The trend lines is what I would pay attention to. And remember this little thing called margin of error. Most people's eyes glaze over when I talk about margin of error, but that's kind of the range that you should be thinking about these poll numbers in when it comes to hearing Donald Trump at 48, Joe Biden at 46. Well, you know, if it's a 3-point margin, they're statistically tied. So, mm-hmm. you know, we need to kind of take a breath. Everybody is so focused on individual polls. Look at them over time. Look at where the trend lines are going. And let's wait until the general campaign kicks into high gear in September before we start making predictions one way or the other about November 5th.
But if Trump's foes are accurate or correct, let's put it that way, that his presidency would present a clear and present danger to both the nation and the world and the future of American democracy, how should voters react? What should the message from Democrats be? Just that? Forget about Joe Biden's accomplishments. Forget about his age. Just get him in.
You know, if that's the message, that's what they should run on. They should hammer it. You know, it's all about, at this point, as Mary has indicated, mobilization, energizing, getting your base out, and persuading the small sliver, both nationally and here in North Carolina, that they need to think about the future of the country if they want the country to continue in this grand experiment of self-governance.
A growing number, Mary, of Democrats were dismayed by several of the answers that the president gave George Stephanopoulos. Among them, a comment that he made was that he was the only candidate who can best address the world's problems. Not only does it sound egotistical and perhaps out of touch, it echoes Donald Trump's "only I can fix it" comment. What would you say to the president about any future defense of his decision to continue to run?
Well, I do think that what Michael said earlier, that people look to the future, means something. So you say, this is what I have done, and I'm going to build on it. Because as he's digging his heels in, that's the question that many Democrats are asking. If indeed we are going through this existential threat of a Trump presidency and what would happen and how we would make America great by rolling things back, you should want to do the best you can to make sure this man doesn't get in. And are you really convinced that you are the best?
Which leads me to the other question, Mary, that he was asked by Stephanopoulos. Stephanopoulos said that if after all his warnings and fears about Trump, he ultimately lost to him when he could have stepped out of the race earlier and put somebody else in his place, the president said he would feel okay as long as he gave it his all. That's a paraphrase, but that's essentially it. Doesn't that neuter his own argument about Trump being an existential threat? And if Democrats truly feel that way, don't they have an obligation to make a change?
Well, I think that what it did was it angered some people. You know, I've been talking to folks, and a lot of people feel that, yes, what else are you going to say? I'm not going to accept the results of the election. That sounds more Trumpian than ever. But he and so many others of a certain class, wealth, whatever, in the United States will be able to weather things. It will really be an existential threat and will affect the lives of people who are minorities, of the poor, you know, immigrants, all of these folks. So they are saying, you know, it isn't just about a participation trophy. It is about life and death for some people. And I think that's one reason why you see them trying to make sure the base is aware of that. You saw Vice President Kamala Harris at the Essence Festival in New Orleans with so many Black women entrepreneurs, folks who are activists who can get the vote out. And you see them going to that to convince people, their base, that it is existential because it is it isn't about you. It's about people's lives. And Trump really has a ceiling. We've seen that. The thing is, he's not really gaining. Biden's losing. So the point is, how do we get those folks excited again? Young people, people like that.
Steve, fears about a Trump presidency or any future presidency that doesn't result in a candidate being placed into office who has character and who would put the nation's interests in front of their own, all of those fears were compounded by that Supreme Court ruling that whatever a president does in their official capacity, he cannot be touched for crimes that they may commit in that capacity. If Democrats retain control of the House, the White House, remain in control of the Senate, retain the House of Representatives, I'll get it out. What can or should be done to protect the country going forward from somebody who is a con man?
Well, I think that the existing, and Michael, I may turn this over to you, is more you study this more than me, but of course, impeachment is still on the table. That has not gone away. That check is still there. Now, of course, Democrats impeached the former president twice and he was not convicted, but that is that has not been taken off the table by the court.
Michael, what about that? How do you protect against this ruling to make sure, because you can't, you don't know what a person is really like or what their real intent is. You can ask him questions so hell freezes over and you're not going to get the truth from a person who has ill intent.
I think this speaks to what political scientists would call the institutions, the guardrails of democracy. The Constitution lays out separation of powers, but what the Supreme Court has done is basically shifted power into the executive branch, particularly into the presidency. And it's not so much the institutions that are going to be the guardrails. It's going to be us. It's going to be human behavior. It's going to be who we put into those offices. Do they respect the basic concept of separate institutions having to share power? Or do they want power for themselves, human ambition, and an unwillingness of others in other institutions to check, to put restraints on them?
But the very fact that you, anybody who thinks they're qualified to be the president of the United States, which makes them the most powerful person in the world, that person has to have a grandiose view of themselves. And that leads to the kind of behavior that we've been protected from mostly, we think, in the past. But now we've had a clear and present fact of somebody in the office who didn't necessarily have anything but his own intent or his own advantage in mind. So how do you protect against that?
I refer you to the Federalist Papers. Ambition must be made to counter ambition. Individuals in other branches of the government must stand up to those individuals that want to pursue the kind of power-driven madness and accumulation of authority to be able to say, you will not broach over this line. And if they choose not to, that is human nature. That is the human fault.
I think too, in the next Trump administration, a lot of people said the guardrails held the first time, but he wasn't experienced, and he put people in that they were old school Republicans that did stop him, say when he wanted to send troops on demonstrators. This time he is more prepared. He has said he will not do that. He will have loyalists in there. They're already compiling lists of people that they would employ when they fire civil servants, and they will say yes to Trump. So the Supreme Court didn't look at what they were seeing in front of them. They were talking about in the future. Well, this is what we have. And as you know, as a Black person, we just celebrated the 60th anniversary, July 2nd, of the signing of the Civil Rights Act that opened public accommodations, schools, pools, libraries, things like that. And it wasn't that long ago. And if you look at Project 2025, some of the things they want to do is to roll those back and give employers the power to discriminate, not just on the issue of race, but gender and ability. This is very serious.
Project 2025 is a blueprint for a bloodless revolution, a fundamental change in how government works and for whom it works and how the levers of power are managed. If you read it, they're making no bones about it, and it's a plan that begins on day one of a new Trump presidency, and if he loses, it would probably be scheduled to begin on day one of the next Republican, because this is all part of a movement, which I think several leaders of this movement, or at least one, has said that this will be bloodless if liberals allow it. What does that tell you, Mary?
Well, it puts the threat of violence out there in a country that has been violent. And as I said, it's not that long ago. Ever since you had, with every, my son's a historian, he always reminds me, with every bit of progress in this country comes pushback. In a sense, you could say that Trump was pushed back to two terms of the first Black president, Barack Obama. And these forces have never gone away. John Roberts, as a law student, was working against the Voting Rights Act. And when he finally got on the court, they neutered it. It's the long game. And, if people think that America is immune to that, they've forgotten January 6th, 2021. And if the election is close, either way, we are capable of this, but we seem to have this amnesia.
January, the amnesia is also led by a whole party who's now reduced January 6th to a tourist visit to the White House, at which some people got a little rowdy. And the people we're talking about are people in the Congress who were running for their lives on that day and seem to have forgotten that. And now you've got a Supreme Court with one of their recent rulings saying they may wipe away some of these convictions of the people already in jail for their participation in January 6th. You have the highest court in the land, which is supposed to be the backstop, in on the deal in many of these. And they have lifetime tenures. And they were meticulously put in place, and they're not acting responsibly in many ways. That they're avoiding the ethics restrictions that frame every judge in the country, except for them. Is the backstop gone?
Yeah, I mean, yes. I mean, go back to my previous comments. I mean, the institutions, the guardrails, the things that were put into the Constitution, and the belief that the framers had about how concentrated power is disruptive, is dangerous, we have moved beyond that, and we are not accepting that premise. And if Donald Trump could do that, remember, presidents, this is what the court said, presidents have absolute immunity. Well, Can Joe Biden do some things that perhaps Republicans would find criminally offensive? He's got carte blanche to do it. The only reason he's not doing it is because he respects the institutions and the belief and the philosophical underpinnings of our constitutional.
10 seconds. If he believes this is an existential crisis and he has the power because the Supreme Court just gave it to him, is it his responsibility to exercise that power?
He can do whatever he wants because he's president of the United States.
And that is dangerous. I'm not sure voters can fix that. Steve Harrison with us, WFAE News. Dr. Michael Bitzer from Catawba College and Mary C. Curtis, a columnist for RollCall.com and host of their Equal Time podcast. Thank you all for the hour.
Celebrating 25 years on the air, Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.